Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today via Zoom, I had with me Ozan Unlu. Ozan is a co-founder and CEO of Edge Delta, a company that is revolutionizing the telemetry pipeline with solutions for observability and security. Edge Delta has successfully raised $82 million in funding and has become a key player in addressing the complex challenges of data processing in real-time environments. With a unique background that spans engineering, sales, and entrepreneurship, Ozan brings a wealth of insights on navigating the transition from technical roles to commercial leadership, the evolving funding landscape, and the future of AI-driven data curation. In today's episode, we talk about retraining your brain away from the technology when you move to selling it, how customers don't always tell you what it is that they actually want, and why selling a spaceship is different from selling a t-shirt.
The analogy I try to use is there are companies that build spaceships and there are companies that sell t-shirts. And if you're selling t-shirts, you better be extremely profitable from day one, right?
How the macro is less relevant when you're raising a seed round and multiple compression in the public markets will impact later stage rounds.
You know, when you have this thing that everyone loves to talk about, which is multiple compression happening in the public markets, then of course you're going to have that affect the startup fundraising scene.
Why raising a round is like putting your house up for sale and how you move from growth to efficiency and back again and how you can actually beat a 6x year.
When you're trying to grow the company by that amount, every single person who's ramped in the company is doing an extremely small amount of work for the company.
How one bad deal can kill your business and how continuous curation and inference means that you can solve big problems in observability and security, especially when you have petabytes of data.
You do have to be very precise, almost at a surgical precision, about which types of data sets should I be feeding into this AI to enable me to be able to get some sort of insight at a reasonable cost.
And how it would take you 1,500 years to read through just 1 terabyte as a human. Ozan's contrarian advice?
You can't control that much as a person.
So we each have our own personalities and paths. Know where you want to go. Let's get straight into it. Hey guys, whilst I've got you for a second, I just thought I'd reintroduce myself. My name's Arish. I'm the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from seed to Series B and beyond. If you like the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you rate and subscribe wherever you listen. And if you ever want to get in touch with me, either to tell me something about the pod or even recommend a guest, do connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter. Right, let's get into it. Ozan, really great to have you with me today and appreciate you waking up quite early. I think you're on West Coast time. So to dive straight in, it can be quite difficult, I think, for highly technical founders to transition into more commercial activities. Interestingly, I just recorded a podcast with a B2B sales kind of advisor for startups. And, you know, we talked about this often kind of irrational fear that technical founders often have around commercial. But from your perspective, how did your technical background influence your approach to sales and customer interactions, given that Sumo Logic, you closed hundreds of logos in your first year and plenty of multi-million deals thereafter? And I guess, what advice would you offer to technical founders who struggle with moving into that commercial role? And how can they develop that sales mindset from your perspective?
Yeah, I think I was very fortunate to have both that experience from being a software developer at Microsoft, as well as, you know, more recently at Sumo Logic being on the customer facing side. So I did have a unique perspective. I think what I typically see from very technical founders, first of all, and I'm sure you've heard it before, is kind of this, if we build it, they will come mentality.
Yeah.
I think a very huge focus on the technology itself is something that you have to almost retrain your brain as a technical person to say, okay, you know, the first question you should almost be asking is, you know, not only what problem am I solving, but who is the exact person I'm selling to in the organization? You know, the software developers are very different from the platform engineers, which are very different from the security analysts, which are very different from, you know, C-level executives. And so you really have to understand who your customer is. And the second part of that is a lot of times your customer isn't going to necessarily tell you exactly what they want. Mm. I think we're seeing this specifically in the AI space. I think the common consensus across a lot of the large organizations and enterprises, specifically within AI, is We know we need to be investing in it, but we don't actually know exactly what it means. We
We
don't
kind
actually know
of know
exactly
we
what
need
we
AI,
need.
but we're not sure where we want to deploy, right?
I think they don't have a very specific thing they need out of it, right? So, I think it takes, especially if you're an early stage founder, it takes you to have an imagination to be able to bridge the gap between what are people doing today and what do you feel like they should be doing tomorrow. And that gap can't be too big either, right? Like, you can't put them in a position where they have to be the ones that are envisioning that future. So you almost have to guide them and take them there. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things is, your customer's not going to tell you what to build.
Yeah, I mean, I think just sort of drawing on that, right? So I guess your point is, well, there's a couple of points, right? So firstly, who it is that you're selling to in the company, there's a couple of ways of looking at that, right? Because you have the economic buyer who may be a purchasing officer, right? Or it might be a budget holder. And then you have the user of the technology that you're trying to sell, who may not be involved in the budget decision beyond proposing a certain solution. So, like, how do you approach that where, you have multiple layers, especially with an enterprise? And we all know how difficult it can be. To break into enterprise and certainly to sell to enterprise, right? Lead times can often be 6, 8, 9 months in terms of going from first conversation to a contract. So how can you ensure that when you are talking to, I guess, that the champion, the user of the product, that there is a, that there is enough of a line between them and the budget holder so that you can actually make that sale, right? Because otherwise you're just, you are evangelizing to someone who's already converted, but you actually need to convert someone else down the track.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I talk to a lot of founders about this, where the analogy I try to use is there are companies that build spaceships and there are companies that sell t-shirts. And if you're selling t-shirts, you better be extremely profitable from day one, right? Your t-shirt cost, it might be whatever, $2 in fabric cost and, $1 in ink and $1 in labor. And your t-shirt costs $4 or $5 and you're selling it for 15 to 20. There's a very easy mathematical calculation there. Then let's say, for instance, you're building a spaceship or spaceship technology, and you're not going to have any revenue or any profits for 5 or 7 or 8 years. And then, of course, in the long term, there's going to be a tremendous amount of value for that technology, whoever your buyer ends up being. That's drastically different in how you're going to go build the business and what metrics you should hold yourself accountable to. And the same thing goes with whether you're kind of doing more of a bottoms-up sales approach or top-down, in that you have to look at, okay, if it's truly bottoms-up, can I just go with a really true PLG motion? In which case, I don't need a very heavy enterprise sales team. I don't need a very heavy process. I don't need to go talk to that customer about, what's your success criteria? And is this a budgeted item? And what are the big business initiatives that we're going to be hitting? And on the contrary, if you are working with large organizations and large problems to solve big issues, then you definitely do need to run that process. So I think the awareness of different types of sales cycles and different types of products and how they fit, a mistake I see a lot with founders is they say, okay, this is my idea and this is my product, and I'd really like to use a PLG model, right? That doesn't always work all the time. You have to have the model that's appropriate with what type of product you're selling. And that's something that I see take quite some time for a lot of people to learn.
Yeah, and I guess the other point there, like PLG product-led growth, ultimately depends on A, there being enough sort of champions, users of your product in the first instance to create the virality where each new feature incrementally then excites people enough that they start sort of buying version 2, version 3, et cetera. And I think a lot of founders, they talk about product-led growth because they haven't figured out really what their acquisition strategy is, right? So there's this sort of assumption that, well, I don't need to go and spend dollars on Facebook ads or Google ads or whatever. I don't need an enterprise sales team because it's fine, the product will sell itself. But often at the earliest stages, like getting your product out of the door into early users' hands is relatively easy, but actually driving that and scaling that you're going to need something more than just, you know, ambition and a bit of hope.
Yeah, I mean, I think it works for certain business models, and you know, I think it works really well for certain business models. I think just having awareness of what you're trying to accomplish and your product and where it fits in with which model, I think that's really, I would highly encourage founders to take the time to really think through that at a very deep level, and also talk to a lot of other founders about their experiences. You know, you don't always get it right at the beginning. And I think taking the time to really think through it, but also to your point, ensuring that you have those early adopters and you have the early design partners that can give you that feedback as well. I think that will give you a lot more context into what type of product you have and what strategy you should be using.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And look, there is no completely right way of doing anything, right? You've got to, and this is the whole point about startups, you test everything, right? Until you land on the strategy that is repeatable and is scalable. So I guess, you know, the point is, don't assume that because company XYZ did it this way, it's going to work for me in the same way. You've got to figure out what is the right strategy for your particular product and your particular market, for that matter, as well. I wanted to shift tack a little bit because, you know, Edge Delta's raised $82 million in funding across the kind of 2020s. And I'm really curious, as someone I think who has raised kind of both sides of that inflection point in the venture market, how the dynamics of that market in early 2022 differ from those in your most recent round. And what do you think it is that investors are prioritizing differently, if anything, now versus then? And also, you know, you and I have talked about the importance of luck and timing, and many people don't mention the former. They don't mention luck. So I'd love for you to kind of expand on that a bit further as well.
Yeah, I think in the early days when we were looking to raise our first round of funding, our seed round, you know, I think nobody can sit here and say, well, I know where the market's going to be in 8 years when you're exiting, right? Mm-hmm. So it's less relevant what's going on in the macro for seed rounds.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we saw when the macro got really difficult, you know, the seed rounds, there was a large influx of cash into the seed rounds because, you know, they're kind of protected from what the macro conditions are today.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's what sort of happened a couple of years ago, where a lot of the, you know, funding and VC firms look to, you know, push a lot of really great ideas, but at the seed stage.
Mm.
Now, on the other side, if you go into later stage funding, it does start to track a lot more closely with the public markets. And so, you know, when you have this thing that everyone loves to talk about, which is multiple compression happening in the public markets, then of course you're going to have that affect the startup fundraising scene. When it comes to luck, I think we were very fortunate that we raised in kind of mid-22. We had, you know, great numbers, great revenue growth, and we were able to raise. And I think for us, fortunately, that meant that we were not dependent on a next round of funding for years.
Yeah.
And a lot of organizations, a lot of companies, a lot of startups, they don't necessarily have that luxury. And so I think, you know, if you're expecting to go fundraise in 6 months and all of a sudden, you know, you thought you were going to be raising at some number and now all of a sudden you're worth a third of that. Well, it puts a lot of pressure, and unfortunately you don't have the runway to be able to kind of reposition in time. The other thing is, you know, if you look at, you know, growth versus efficiency, if we think about growth, right, 20% annual growth compounded over 5 years is very different than 200% annual growth compounded over 5 years. You know, I don't have the math on me, but it's probably orders of magnitude different, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, as your early stage, if you're growing at 200-300%, it also, there's not really a comp in the public markets as well, right? So I think, you know, ensuring that you're threading the needle and you're being efficient, but you're also holding on to that growth, I think that's probably been the most challenging thing, you know, in the last couple of years of operating as a, you know, mid-stage startup.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about that a bit further in a second, but I mean, I guess one of the questions I would have, like, certainly, you know, having raised, as you say, you know, your seed round early doors and then gone out for a round more recently. How did you see valuations? Like, was it harder to push for the sort of valuations that at seed you would have expected to go out and raise your Series A at or your Series B at? Or did it actually work out relatively sort of flat in terms of your expectations?
Yeah, I think my expectations were fairly aligned. You know, it's funny, you go out there to fundraise and sometimes the first few pitches you do are like a slap in the face of reality, sure. Right? Sometimes you go out there and someone says, you're nuts for thinking this. You know, of course, it's like selling a house. You don't need to price the house at a point where every single person wants to buy it at that point. You know, you need one or two buyers, but you also want to be reasonable, right? You don't want to go have some crazy valuation that someone agreed to that all of a sudden is going to make your life a lot harder in the next 2 or 3 years. So I think it was pretty aligned with my expectations. I don't think it was anything out of the ordinary, but you know, there are certain metrics and milestones, and in the seed stage, it's a lot more about storytelling. It's a lot more about, you know, how big could this opportunity be? And in the later stages, it's a lot more about the numbers, right? Yeah. So, you know, I think the numbers can still tell the story, but it's less aspirational and a lot more real.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely kind of our experience across, you know, across the fundraising market over the last several years. And I think, you know, I've spoken to founders who had raised on that aspirational story, who were still expecting to raise on an aspirational story despite their numbers not necessarily tracking in the right direction, but they'd raised it very high valuation kind of at their seed in 2021, let's say. And now they're going back to market where actually, you know, their revenue's off, their traction's not there, and they're hoping to beat that valuation. We've talked a lot on this podcast in the past about, you know, how should you think about a down round and or a flat round, and, you know, when is it appropriate, when isn't it? I think founders now, and certainly founders that have been building over the last couple of years, as opposed to the last sort of 4 or 5 years, or certainly founders that, you know, didn't start building until after 2022 versus, you know, maybe 2019, 2020. I think that realization that actually that those metrics need to be kind of on point from, not from day one, but certainly, you know, they need to be tracking towards those. I think has become more ingrained as opposed to what it was like, again in 2021, et cetera, where, you know, realistically, as you know, if you could tell a good story, you could probably raise at large valuations with large amounts of capital flowing in. I guess the only other, I guess maybe question on that is, you know, your product is one that requires heavy engineering, right? And you are selling to enterprise, which, as you say, cycles are slow. Like you need both the working capital in terms of ensuring that you can sell to your clients, but also in order to build an enterprise grade product, right? You know, do you aspire to, it's kind of a double-edged question, so I'm not sure you'd even want to answer it, but, you know, is your aspiration to obviously build the rocket ship and exit, you know, for an incredible valuation? Or, you know, having looked back over the last several years, do you think that actually, you know what, if I can get this business into a really good shape and run it kind of profitably, is that what you would do? I mean, again, we're going to talk about this a bit further, but I just, you know, just kind of off the top of your head, what is your almost preferred pathway?
Well, I mean, I think you have to keep an open mind to either approach. But, you know, for us, we've always been about solving very big problems and doing it in an exciting way. You know, I think if you look at the market and what it's been the last couple of years, you still have the option to function in either regard. You could either function high efficiency or high growth. The challenge is, if you wanted to function in high growth, the margin for error was extremely slim,
yeah,
right? So if you try to function with high growth, and let's say, you know, you were optimistic about the product, but it wasn't quite there yet, or, you know, I don't know, something happened, a comet hit your, you know, hit your HQ and you had to, you know, move offices. I don't know. Something crazy could have happened. The margin for error is very slim, where all of a sudden, if your burn is high, you just have no recourse, right? Now there are lots of great companies out there that decided we're going to go take that risk, and we're going to continue to go with high growth and high burn, and we're going to, take the good and the bad, the pros and the cons that come along with that. And then there's a lot of organizations that decided to go the other route, which is, okay, let's go bide our time. Let's go make sure that we're putting the investments in the right areas, but we don't want to function with that very slim margin of error. And I think either approach is fine. We're very fortunate our business is doing really well. So we haven't had to make that black or white decision where we say, hey, we're only going to go into efficiency mode and try to be profitable, or we're going to go burn a lot of cash to go try to hit some numbers. And if we miss by a quarter, we're in a really tough shape. I think we've been very fortunate, again, from the timing of our fundraise, where we had a lot of capital to work with, but also in us being able to build a long-term enterprise product that, to your point, a lot of what we've done is really ha made those long-term investments. And that's, if I look at the last 2, 3 years of us functioning, that's the most exciting thing for me is we never slowed down R&D. We never were in a tough spot where we said, hey, we need our go-to-market team to hit some numbers, but we just don't have the ability to go continue to invest in the product. So we need to hit these, mid to short-term goals, and we have to leverage and effectively take on a lot of tech debt in the long term. That is what I saw a lot of other organizations unfortunately have to do. And that goes back to the luck, right? I think we've done a very good job of how we've operated, but also part of it is just we got very lucky with the timing of our fundraise, that we were in a fortunate position where we didn't have to make a lot of those tough decisions.
Yeah, you had the balance sheet to be able to cope with it. I guess, and we're going to talk about this sort of this intersection of growth and efficiency now. I mean, part of the problem is that, A, there's been a huge amount of ink spilled about this sort of transition from growth to efficiency, not just ink spill, but words spilled as well as we're currently doing. So maybe I'm just adding to adding to that kind of massive volume of stuff that's been said and written. But actually that ink that has been spilled has often been more by investors than founders, right? Like, so I don't hear necessarily founders saying, well, I'm going to make that exactly to your point, right? I'm going to make the choice between growth and efficiency. In fact, if anything, I think most founders were like, okay, we're still going to grow. We'll just be a bit more efficient about how we approach that, right? But from your perspective, you were obviously able to change the focus a little bit. And as you say, luck played a bit of a part there. But more importantly, as you pivot back to kind of more growth mode, especially after the fundraise, what are you doing to kind of maintain some of the benefits that the efficiency you brought into the business? How are you maintaining those benefits, and what are those benefits? Like, were you able to do things when you sort of went down that efficiency path that is now paying dividends as you head back into the kind of growth mode?
I think looking at our own history, I mean, we've gone very high efficiency, we've gone very high growth. Looking back at our history, there was a year where we 6X'd the company. So we grew by 6X in 1 year. And the challenge was, you think about someone functioning at 100% focus and efficiency, and then you think about someone, literally not working. And the challenge ends up being is that when you're trying to grow the company by that amount, every single person who's ramped in the company is doing an extremely small amount of work for the company. They're working their butt off, but they're recruiting, they're interviewing, they're onboarding, they're ramping, they're trying to impart all of the culture and the knowledge and the everything about the company to all the new people that are being brought on. And it ends up being that you have a lot of new people that are learning, and a lot of the existing team that's not doing the core work.
Yeah, so you got
And
this sort of
so
execution mismatch, right?
and I think it's almost like a double whammy where you get hit on both sides, right? And so I think that's probably the toughest part is, again, going back to a startup, your superpower is how fast you can grow and how fast you can grow revenue. And you have to do that to go compete with incumbents. But at the same time, what's almost exciting about this newer era is that there aren't these ridiculous expectations where, hey, you were 50 employees today. I need you to be 500 employees in a year. And I need you to be 1,000 employees in a year and a half, right? So that sort of growth expectation, I don't think is reasonable. Maybe we just didn't do it right. But I think realistically, it's really hard to hit that balance of growing, but also not just having your efficiency and frankly, your effectiveness to be able to work on the product and to be able to go sell the product to really take a pretty big hit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like what you're describing is, I guess, that the sort of methodology of blitzscaling, right? Which obviously people will know from Reid Hoffman's book, which was kind of the, it was the Bible, if you like, during those sort of early 2020s. And actually, that's been thrown right out of the window because blitzscaling was literally about not being efficient. It was about, essentially excessive spend across everything just to reach that scale, which was highly inefficient, right? Like, so to your point, you're throwing money at problems that you maybe don't have. You're throwing money at problems to solve the problems that you weren't solving earlier. And then, as you say, you're ramping up growth by bringing on headcount, but you're spending more time figuring out how to onboard that headcount and how to get them to do stuff rather than actually executing on the product or on the sales or whatever it is. So no, I completely get it. And I think, I think actually, some of it comes from kind of a finance CFO background. I've always been about both growth and efficiency, right? Like you can grow efficiently. There is nothing wrong. Does it mean you'll grow slower? Maybe, not necessarily. But I think efficiency drives you to make sort of decisions that are as impactful as possible, right? The highest sort of ROI kind of decisions. Whereas if you are just blitzscaling or trying to grow without, without that discipline, then you potentially end up doing yourself a disfavor because essentially you don't have the focus to know where you are, where you should really be spending your time and your money.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think the tough, unfortunate part as well is that in the market where everyone's quote unquote blitzscaling, you kind of get dragged into it as well, right? Like you're forced to do that. If employees are looking around saying, "Well, we must be the ones failing because we're not the ones blitzscaling," or if you're just not able to recruit or whatever else, you're forced into also these unreasonable, recruiting fees and unreasonable expectations for, what you should be doing and everything else. So I think, part of the relief about this market is, for us, we're able to be efficient, we're able to have high growth. All that feels a lot more natural than it did 3 years ago.
So you're in the envious position of being able to have your cake and eat it. So no, look, and again, as I say, I think efficient growth is a pathway to essentially better outcomes for you as a founder as much as anything else, right? Because you tend to take on less capital, you dilute less, you have more optionality when it comes to thinking about whether you want to grow further, whether you want to exit, how you want to exit, whether that's IPO, whether that's looking for a strategic acquirer, whether that's exiting to kind of private equity or whatever. If you are growing but don't have the cash discipline, then you may end up having to take a worse deal. Whereas if you're growing efficiently and you are being disciplined about how you burn, the reality is you're going to be much more likely to find the right sort of deal on your terms as opposed to being you essentially become a deal maker rather than a deal taker.
Well, and I think, to your point, you mentioned a bad deal. I think what a lot of people don't realize is it only takes one bad deal to ruin a company, right? And there's no going back from that. And I think that's the unfortunate thing is if you do decide to go high growth in this market and you do miss and you do take that bad deal, there are so many times where it's almost impossible for there to be any sort of good outcome for Common. And that to me, as obviously a founder operator, That's my number one thing is all the people that put their blood, sweat, and tears into this thing for years and years and years, you'd like to believe that there is some really nice outcome for them financially in the long term. And so that's what I see is a lot of organizations where if you had to take that bad deal, then it becomes very difficult to see some sort of, of course, you can always become the $100 billion company and go be, the largest software IPO of all time. But if you're not, there's almost no outcome there that works well for Common. And I've been very, again, very fortunate, but also very careful that I don't put our company in that position where, all of a sudden, there's not a huge upside for all the people that are putting, their blood, sweat, and tears in every single day.
And we've seen, there's been a raft of stories over the last 12 months of kind of half billion plus exits, where due to the preference stack, founders, employees just, essentially get wiped out, right? And don't really make much from their endeavors. So yeah, I mean, I think, and it's a cautionary tale, I think, right? I mean, there are businesses out there that I know, that I've come across where founders have been diluted down, like at very early stage, have been diluted down so significantly that actually they are going to need to be made whole by investors in order to be able to take, and these are great businesses, but you can't see a Series A or a Series B investor coming in when the cap table looks that messy, right? But I think, there's this attitude often amongst startup founders where it's like, well, any cash at any, as long as I can keep the business going, then great. But that's a very short-termist attitude. And often you can't repair that down the track, right? If someone's sitting there with a 3x, 3x liquidity preference, you're going to struggle to claw that back.
Yeah, and I think, to be fair to the VC community as well, I think for the most part, and maybe I'm just fortunate, and maybe I've just worked with, great investors, but for the
Clearly.
most part, I think also investors, they understand that, right? They understand if we put the company in a position where, the cap table looks unattractive, of course, what's going to happen is, in the future rounds, they're going to be devalued, right? So I think, what we saw happening 10 or 15 years ago did not happen nearly as much in the last 5 years. So I would say, the industry is evolving. I think we've all seen those horror stories and we've all seen the repercussions of something like that. Now, of course, in the last couple of years, if a company was just in a bad spot, they probably didn't have any other options, right? So, it's also, you mentioned, eating your cake and having it too. It's difficult in some regards if you do, again, function with the high burn strategy. But again, at seed round, there's no such thing as efficiency at seed round. You're not going to be profitable. Again, you could be selling t-shirts or, the equivalent in tech, which is a true PLG motion where someone swipes their credit card for $20 a month and they're just, onboarding and your expenses are really low. But any sort of enterprise sales cycle, it's just not going to happen.
100%. Look, I want to switch tack again a little bit and talk about Edge Delta. I mean, I am not a technical person, as many people who listen to this podcast will probably have figured out by now, although I do love me a bit of technical talk. So I want to understand how your approach to continuous curation and inference addresses the challenge of processing vast amounts of machine-generated data in real time, right? And I guess looking ahead, how do you see this evolving in the context of advancements, not only in AI, but the thing that very few people talk about, or at least in the public kind of domain, you don't hear as much about, which is quantum computing, right? So how do you look at that from Edge Delta's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think, the continuous curation and inference is something that we've innovated on. And it really comes from the core of data is growing a lot faster than budgets, right? I think some numbers out there have about 30% annual data growth. But realistically, even as a non-techie, I'm sure you've heard the term of like Kubernetes or microservices,
Of course.
where there's these new types of architectures that people are moving to. And when you're moving from a more traditional architecture to something newer and more modern, it's not just 30%, it's not just 50%. Sometimes you're getting 100 or 200% growth in data volumes when it comes to these logs, metrics, and traces. Now, I think we can all remember back in, I think it was what, November of 22, when ChatGPT released, and we all saw that bar, and we all went to the website and we all typed something in, and we were just trying to learn about, okay, what is really inference and how do I work with an AI to really solve my problems and answer my questions. We have to think about, as humans, if you're typing into that box, even the fastest typers are, whatever, 150, 200 words per minute. Machines can generate data a million times faster than that. And so the challenge ends up becoming, okay, here at Edge Delta, we're not going to go compete with Anthropic or OpenAI or any, or open source Llama, or even, recently DeepSeek, right? We're not going to go compete with foundation models and go try to come up with our better model. Our approach is really, how do we go apply AI at scale when some of our largest customers create petabytes of data per day? And so I think that's what really, for us, we've been really focused on the last couple of years, is this concept of continuous curation and inference. One, if we're not going to be building foundation models, we don't care that much about training ourselves, or fine-tuning for that matter. For us, we're really focused on inference, which is, how do you solve big problems in observability and security using inference from some of these LLMs and models? And so, for us, if you think about the volume of data, there's no way you can go put petabytes of data into any LLM or AI. I mean, you're not going to spend $1 billion a day trying to go infer something about your data. Most businesses wouldn't even be able to do $1 million a day,
Yeah.
much less a billion. And so it's really, really important that you are thoughtful about how you're using AI in this space of observability and security, because again, the data volumes are so big. So what continuous curation and inference does is it actually can identify the small nuggets of high-value data sets that you should be feeding in to AI to be able to get some sort of response. And for us, we have a feature in our product called On-Call AI. And what On-Call AI will do is it will actually identify what is the potential root cause of an issue, and what is the suggested remediation action for solving this, potential production outage or some sort of degradation in your services. Now, if you're waking up at 3 in the morning, are you going to look at that recommendation and take it as gospel? Probably not. But isn't it quite nice that you don't have to, as your eyes are adjusting, as your screen is starting to warm up, isn't it nice that you don't have to start at square one and you can start at square five?
Yeah.
So when we talk about continuous curation and inference in the space of observability and security, where there's massive amounts of data, you do have to be very precise, almost at a surgical precision, about which types of data sets should I be feeding into this AI to, enable me to be able to get some sort of insight at a reasonable cost. So it's always about that, value to cost ratio. I think AI is great in that regard, but these data volumes are astronomically larger than what you can, as a human, you can type.
Yeah.
I mean, even a terabyte. Sometimes I give some talks, and this is a stat that always blows people's minds. I'm going to ask you, do you know, or could you guess how long it would take you to manually read through 1 terabyte of logs?
I think I've seen this stat somewhere myself, but it's something, it's like 100 million years or something. It's like something ridiculous.
Yeah, it's 1,500 years
Yeah.
as a human
Okay,
if you were
maybe
to
less
sit
than a
and read
hundred
through
million.
1 terabyte.
Yeah.
And some of our customers do petabytes of
Yeah.
data per day, right? So it's just completely unfeasible. And I think at that level, even with, you mentioned quantum computing,
Yeah.
even with, I think with DeepSeek, and we can see that the cost of these models and the cost of inference within these models is going to go down. But in a future where it goes down, you still have to be thoughtful. And that's why at Edge Delta, we're really focused on this concept of continuous curation and inference, which is, for all the data sets that are being created across all of my services, across all of my production environments, what are the very, very high value data sets, whether the logs, metrics, or traces, that I can go feed into LLMs to be able to get some sort of additional value out of that data, other than just simply what my engineers have already known from before?
Yeah, I mean, so to me, what it sounds like, it's sort of, I mean, it's sort of needle in the haystack, right? So essentially, what you're able to do is look across all of the data, identify those key pieces that require additional thought or additional kind of understanding, and draw attention to those, right? I think you talked about whether Anthropic, ChatGPT, DeepSeek, etc. Like, for the casual user, you know, lots of what you're saying will not make sense because, okay, for me, I'll open up ChatGPT, I'll write a message, I'll get a message back. It still feels like pretty magical, but I think it's also very difficult when you operate with kind of smaller businesses, certainly as I do, because you aren't generating petabytes of data. But if you are a PwC, if you are a Microsoft, if you are a Salesforce, you are generating that volume of data. And there is just no way, right, that someone sitting at a chat terminal is necessarily going to be able to figure out what that data is telling them. So I can absolutely see why it makes sense. I think... just one question maybe on this. So, I mean, you touched upon it, but, as the cost of these language models comes down, what that essentially, I assume, means is there'll be more data because there'll be more usage, right? Which only makes, a tool like Edge Delta even more important, surely.
Yeah, certainly. I think for us, we've always been focused on inference rather than training or fine tuning. That's just where we've put in our expertise and where we've utilized it for observability and security teams. But I think, as the cost of these models come down, absolutely, you're going to want to be using it on more data sets. And our core product, by the way, is telemetry pipelines. And telemetry pipelines, the big thing that lets you do is to take any different piece of data and go send it from A to B. Right. And so a lot of organizations, they are using these data tiering strategies where they're saying, OK, I want to go take all my data and go store it in the absolute lowest cost storage, which, happens to be effectively object storage like AWS S3. Yeah. Right. AWS S3 is orders of magnitude less expensive than tools like Datadog and Splunk. Mm. And those are orders of magnitude less expensive than LLM models. Right. Mm. So you have to have this concept of data tiering where you say, the appropriate data needs to go to the appropriate downstream destination. And that's what our core product, Telemetry Pipelines, allows you to do, for all the observability and security teams out there that are working with these large data sets. So I think, bringing it all back to AI, if the cost of the models go down, you're certainly able to do a lot more inference. Mm. But, it also opens up a lot more use cases for you to be able to actually apply those models to some of these problems.
Yeah. Look, makes a huge, from what I can understand, it makes a huge amount of sense. I wanted to kind of close off with one final question, which we ask all of our guests. What is one thing where you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is the kind of hill that you would die on?
I'll just throw out there something that I touched on maybe at the very beginning of this episode, which is, I'm a big believer that you can't control that much as a person.
Yeah.
And what I mean is, I don't choose to be a startup founder. Mm-hmm. I think it's just something that innately is something that I feel like the itch that I have to do. And, I think a lot of people, especially in the high growth era, where you're interviewing numerous people every single day, and you really have to be aware of, what do you want? Do you want a work-life balance? And do you want kind of to be in a large organization? Or do you want to be at a startup? And to me, it really does feel like those are two different types of people.
Yeah.
And neither one is right or wrong. I think you just have to have that self-awareness of, am I going to be happy at a startup? Am I going to be bored at a large company? Or vice versa. Am I going to be unhappy at a startup because I'm not getting the work-life balance? Or, am I going to be really happy at a large company because, I get to work on the things with less pressure?
Yeah.
So I think, I'm not sure how exactly contrarian that view is, but, I am a big believer that, as humans ourselves, we can't change our personalities. We can't change what we want. So, I would say have that awareness. Know where you want to be And I think it'll cause a lot less stress to you in the long run.
I can't, I couldn't argue with that at all. I would agree with it fully. I mean, I remember I used to kind of mentor and advise at sort of universities to some extent. And I remember like grads would come and or undergrads would come up to me and say, "Hey, look, I mean, I really want to get into startups. You know, how do I know that this is the right startup?" I said, "Well, if anyone knew which was the right startup, you know, we'd all be billionaires, right? Like, so there is no answer." And actually, if you dug into what it was that they were looking for, they wanted the sort of sex appeal of a startup, but actually the security and the comfort of a probably later stage startup. So when they talked about startups, they're you know, they want to join a Salesforce or a Facebook or a Google, you know, which are clearly not startups, but I think in people's mentality, I mean, obviously probably not those, but they wanted to, you know, they want to join a business that's sort of at Series C, D, already fairly kind of secure, just you know, getting ready to make its way out there with an exit. And I would always ask them, why do you want to join a startup? I said, actually, joining a startup straight out of school could either be incredibly good, but actually 9 times out of 10, it's going to be an awful experience for you because you're not going to get any training, you're not going to get any mentoring, you're going to be thrown at the deep end, you're going to have to figure some stuff out you may not know how to do. And what are you optimizing for? And often what they're optimizing for was the logo or the you know, or being able to say that they worked at a startup. I know, and I've gone through this myself quite a lot. I'm very, very certain that I would hate working. In fact, you know, I worked at corporates for 3 or 4 years of my life, 4 years after I graduated university, and haven't worked with one since. And I don't think I could go back and do that. Like, I honestly know that that is just not part of my makeup. So yeah, I couldn't agree more.
And I think, you know, you touched on the point of someone coming in saying, how do I know which startup to join? Maybe that's even a more contrarian viewpoint of mine, which is, you know, I am a big believer in large, efficient markets as well. And that comes all the way down to startups, right? So, you know, let's take a look at, let's say in 23, when OpenAI was the hottest, quote unquote, you know, I don't know if I would call it a startup, but quote unquote startup out there. Well, guess what? You know, of course everyone wants to go join that company. And of course, you're not going to get a ton of equity. And of course, you know, you're not going to get a great salary and you know, there might not be so much upside. And vice versa, if you do go to a startup that has less funding and more risk, then of course there is a lot more opportunity there. And, you know, there is no get rich quick scheme out there. You know, of course, you can have your theories. You can say, hey, like, I'm really curious about, you know, this idea. I think this is going to be big in the future. You know, and you could be right about that. And you could go hit it big at some startup. But, you know, to say like, okay, well, this is a very low risk, you know,
High upside.
high upside opportunity, and I'm just going to go find that. And for some reason, for whatever reason, they're going to hire me, and just give me gobs and gobs of equity. You know, I'm a big believer in efficient large markets that, you know, that opportunity doesn't necessarily exist.
By the time you realize, everyone else has realized as well, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Ozan, it's been absolutely incredible having you on the podcast. For the audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where can they look for you on the interweb?
Yes, so I am mostly on LinkedIn. That's typically where I'm at. So Ozan Unlu, Ozanunlu. Find me, follow me, add me as a contact. Happy to meet and chat with some of you. And then, you know, EdgeDelta.com, just like it sounds like it's spelled, EdgeDelta.com is where our company. And again, if you're in observability and security and you're listening, come talk to us. We have some really interesting technology around telemetry pipelines, and we'd love to chat.
Amazing. Well, look, Ozan, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.